love me in the morning, so now I'm taking my time. At night I'm feeling the vibe, a connoisseur. Yo, shit is a connoisseur. I grind on my back, I'm battling karma. Your honor, pleading the fifth. We looking for leadership. Who the fuck is leading the shit?
Just like the stars above you shine for us all to see.
WBI 99.5 FM, Rebel Diaz Radio. We wind it down. 2 minutes left. I gotta read the joints that I've been playing. I think I forgot what I was playing, but I know I played y'all some things. Nah, we broke that record. Vic Mensa, OMG featuring Pusha T off of his new EP, The Manuscript. Make sure y'all pick that up. Support dope hip-hop and young artists that saying things. And then speaking of that, we follow that up with Loaf Music, Timeless. Make sure y'all check out their project. They got a new single out. They ain't sent me the new version yet, but I got to get the clean version for show. So make sure y'all support and check out artists like Loaf Music. But I got 1 minute left before the peoples come in here and tell me I got to get off the airwaves.
I tell you, gotta ride
but
out.
Until then, I'm still on, shorty. I'm still on. Hold on.
Saturday at the point. Don't forget.
Saturday at the point. 940 Garrison Ave. 2 to 6 p.m. The Ungovernables. Free barbecue and showcase.
Oh, man.
So Dot X performing live. Merce the Big Body Benz. Fred Ones on the ones and twos. DJ KK47. The debut performance of Rebel Diaz and Seth Post Multiply Project. I'm going to read this track list and then we out here. Rebel Mix. That was Big Cousin with Living. Ghost of the Machine featuring Black McCloud for a bit of knowledge. Molecules by Jungle. GS Advance featuring Spit Gems. Chop Clark with 40 Acres and Supreme Soul for My Own Good. That was Rebel Mix number 2. Thank y'all for tuning in. This is Rebel Diaz Radio. Every Wednesday, 10 p.m. to midnight on WBAI. Make sure y'all tune in next week. It is what it is, y'all. Salute y'all. Hip-hop, politics, and culture live and direct. Peace.
Because of busy signals or have to pull over to the side of the road or miss the show you were listening to in order to make your pledge.
Blah, 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 blah.
Now you can donate and choose your thank you gift online at your convenience at any time. Go to the new WBAI online donation site at www.give2wbai.org. That's give, the number 2, WBAI.org. You can also pledge in the name of your favorite show, choosing it from the drop-down menu, and whether you would like to be thanked on the air. Just go to www.give2wbai.org.
Yo, this is G-Love on WBAI, New York, New York.
Do you want your favorite WBAI programming to continue to air without the Fun Drive Day preemption? Becoming a BAI buddy is a great way to prevent that and to help support the station. Just by going to give2wbai.org, you can donate today. So before you decide to buy that electronic accessory for your smartphone, here are some more fulfilling ways to use that money with some perks. You can use your WBAI membership card and receive discounts on Zipcar, 2 for the price of 1 admission at the Museum of the City of New York, 20% off session with life and career coach Nina Delavecchia, and much more. You will also receive a WBAI tote bag, which you can use to carry around some on-air giveaways. For more information, go to give2, that's the number 2, WBAI.org.
Hi, this is Donovan, and you're tuned to WBAI, listener-supported, non-commercial radio in New York.
Hello and welcome to Help Action here on listener-supported community radio WBAI in New York. I'm Mark Hannay, Director of Metro New York Healthcare for All and a member of the Health Action Collective that brings you this program every week. In this week's program, in the first half, we're going to be talking to a couple of activist leaders nationally and locally about all the activism that's happening in Congress in response to the congressional healthcare bills. In the second half of the program, Catherine Davis will be here with a live interview discussion about holistic eye care. But first, we'll start with the Health Action News for this week, taken from stories posted to KaiserHealthNews.org. The path to 50 votes for an Affordable Care Act replacement bill in the Senate seemed to narrow dramatically last week with efforts to craft a quick compromise as it foundered. However, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has about $200 billion to build a bridge to victory, and his deal-making may be just beginning. While many policy experts, lobbyists, and senators seem skeptical that McConnell's bill, known as the Better Care Reconciliation Act, could be saved, they said they could envision a way for him to succeed in crafting a bill that would partially replace the Affordable Care Act. McConnell has significant wiggle room in his repeal bill. Under the budget bills he's using to move the legislation, he needs to reach $133 billion in deficit reduction over 10 years. The Congressional Budget Office estimated that his bill would save considerably more, around $321 billion. That leaves nearly $200 billion in deficit savings that McConnell can afford to give back and use to make deals with as many as a dozen senators who said they oppose his draft bill. However, figuring out exactly how to spread the financial confectionery around is no simple matter. The key problem for McConnell's bill is very similar to the one that nearly brought down the House version of similar legislation. Conservatives want to repeal more of the law and do it more quickly, while more centrist Republicans are worried about the damage that would be done by extracting a huge cut of hundreds of billions of dollars from Medicaid and eliminating popular consumer protections for health insurance. Moderate senators want all the expansion of Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act preserved or at least rolled back much more gently than the Senate or House bills propose. And they want to preserve treatment dollars for the opioid crisis raging in their states. Even senators from deeply conservative states oppose the bill's draconian Medicaid cuts, which would likely punish rural hospitals in their states. All of them need money added back to Medicaid, especially after a new congressional budget analysis released last week said the program's cuts jumped from 25% after the first 10 years to a staggering 35% in the second decade. They also have concerns about provisions that would allow states to waive minimum standards in the Affordable Care Act, including its essential health benefits and protections for people with pre-existing conditions. On the conservative side, the pressure has been on to cut taxes established by the health law and to roll back insurance regulations so that states could craft whatever rules they wanted. The House bill would let states get waivers for the 10 essential health benefits required by law. Competing interests seem to be diametrically opposed, but McConnell's ability to tap that $200 billion could go a long way to ease the friction. How he doles out that largesse is another part of the puzzle. There are some other levers McConnell has, but they are issues unrelated to the health bill per se. McConnell's and senators, however, would have to act as if it's not a quid pro quo. NPR reports that there are about 22 million military veterans in the U.S., but fewer than half get their care through the Veterans Affairs system. Some don't qualify for various reasons, or may live too far from a VA facility to easily get primary health care there. Many vets instead rely on Medicaid for their health insurance. 31 states and the District of Columbia chose to expand Medicaid to cover more people under the Affordable Care Act, and many of those who gain coverage are military veterans. The Republican health care bill, working its way through the Senate, would dramatically reduce federal funding for Medicaid, including rolling back the expansion funding entirely between 2021 and 2024. Medicaid coverage recently has become important to these veterans. The Senate health plan has military veterans and their advocates worried. It's too soon to know how many of them might lose coverage as a result of the Medicaid reductions. First, states would have to make some tough decisions, whether to make up the lost federal funding, to limit benefits, or restrict who would get coverage. About 500,000 military veterans today are enrolled in the VA's health care program, as well as in some source of other coverage, such as Medicaid or Medicare. A recent report from Families USA showed that nearly 1 in 10 veterans are enrolled in Medicaid. Whether a particular veteran qualifies for coverage through the VA depends on a host of variables that leaves many with Medicaid as the only options. But the report said that rather than fighting to preserve Medicaid access, veterans would be better served by efforts to reform the care the VA provides to those who qualify. The Urban Institute found that the first 2 years after enactment of the Affordable Care Act earlier this decade saw nearly a 44% drop in the number of uninsured military veterans under age 65. The total went down from 980,000 to 552,000. In large part, that was a result of the Affordable Care Act's expansion of Medicaid. And finally, the congressional newspapers The Hill and Politico report that President Trump has nominated Dr. Jerome Adams, an Indiana health official, to be the next nation's Surgeon General. Dr. Adams, an anesthesiologist and an African American, has served as the Indiana State Health Commissioner and was appointed by then-Governor Mike Pence. President Trump abruptly fired the previous Surgeon General, Dr. Vivek Murthy, without explanation. Dr. Murthy had been a supporter of the Affordable Care Act, an advocate for comprehensive treatment of addiction, and had argued for treating gun violence as a public health problem. Dr. Adams has been on the faculty of the Indiana University School of Medicine, where he also completed his medical degree and medical residency. He has also received several civilian awards, including the Indiana Rural Health Association Health Policy Advocate Award, the Indiana University Early Career Achievement Award, and the Indiana University Teaching Award. Dr. Adams has also worked at Eskenazi Health and has been involved in a number of policy initiatives, including diversity within the American Society of Anesthesiologists. If confirmed, Dr. Adams would replace Rear Admiral Sylvia Trent Adams, the current acting Surgeon General. Trent Adams took over the post in April after President Trump dismissed the previous Surgeon General. The White House included the announcement in a release listing several nominations that are now being sent on to the Senate. And that's the Health Action News for this week. We'll be back with our first interview segment about all the current activism that's happening around the current congressional health care bills. Stay tuned. Welcome to Health Action. I'm Mark Hannay. In this week's first interview segment, we're going to be taking a look at all the activism that's happening around the current congressional health care bills, both out in the states and cities and counties and in Washington, D.C. itself. Joining us is Mark Milano, who's a member of Rise and Resist and a leader of their healthcare action group, and Jennifer Flynn, who's a consultant and healthcare coordinator with the Center for Popular Democracy. Welcome to Health Action, Mark and Jennifer.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you.
So, Jennifer, let me start with you. How is the activist community sort of approaching this strategically, this fight that's happening in Congress right now? What are some of the concerns, things we have that they're thinking about and implementing?
Yeah, so since the House passed their incredibly dangerous health care, so-called health care bill, there's actually been an amazing number of actions taken across the country by grassroots organizations that are highly, highly coordinated, and activists that are highly coordinated. And, you know, until last week, there was this narrative put forth by Mitch McConnell, Senator McConnell, and other Republican senators that they weren't hearing from their constituents. And we were just baffled by it because we knew that there were hundreds of thousands of phone calls that were going into offices. Now, granted, you know, they were going into offices, but oftentimes they would never pick up the line, so we think that they probably just disconnected their phones, or they couldn't get through. But we knew that that was happening. We knew that there was at least two actions a week happening in front of some of the key Senate targets, like Senator Toomey, like Senator Capito, like Senator Portman, Senator Cotton. We knew that, you know, as of 2.5 weeks ago, activists from West Virginia were boarding a bus, driving all night so that they could go find Senator Capito in the Senate office buildings. And also from Columbus, Ohio, activists boarded a bus all night to have an overnight vigil to drive to Washington, D.C. to make it to Senator Portman's regularly scheduled coffee for tourists from Ohio. And we knew that all of that stuff was happening on top of countless other demonstrations and, you know, really creative stuff was going on. People in Arkansas and North Carolina made paper mache pigs and put lipstick on, had little kids putting lipstick on the pig to show that the Senate bill was just going to be lipstick on a pig, a really terrible, you know, the same thing as the House bill. And normally that would get press, but there was just a blackout of press, and so they were able to say that there was no action. So in the past couple weeks, we really realized that the local reporters didn't have the freedom to write a national story, you know, about our national healthcare system,
right.
and that the national media wasn't covering it because there was really an intentional blackout, or because there was so much activity, which is my theory, that they actually just couldn't figure out what to cover. So, you know, we started to get a little bit more creative about packaging things together. So some of the work that we actually did together was to hold these 24-hour vigils. So, you know, rolling, pun intended, off of the overnight bus trips on Monday from West Virginia and Tuesday from Ohio. There was a 24-hour vigil that started in Columbus Circle that had about 20 people spend the whole night. At one point had over 200 seniors from Westside Federation for Senior and Supportive Housing, seniors in desperate need of Medicare and Medicaid that also provided for their living situation, not just for their health care. And then following that, an amazing 24-hour vigil in front of every single office of Senator Toomey's all throughout Pennsylvania. So that's Wilkes-Barre, Erie, Philadelphia, Allentown, and there's five or six, so I'm missing two, but every single place where he had an office, they had a 24-hour vigil. And that started to kind of, you know, be the crow in the crowbar, in the crack, to make a little bit of room. But last week, some of us participated, Mark included, in pulling off a coordinated civil disobedience action in the Senate that targeted those key senators. And because I think it was one place where the national press could come, it really did break the seal, and national press, an unbelievable amount of national press was reported, you know, reporting on the action. And also, actually, you know, in Arkansas, there was a big front page story about the action. In Alaska, there were stories. So it also made way and gave some space for some of the local press to cover it. So hopefully that applied some nice pressure. And this is a big week for us. Today, Wednesday, July 5th, is the National Day of Action on Healthcare for Healthcare for America Now. So there's actions happening all over the country today.
Mark, to bring you into the conversation, Rise and Resist started doing, speaking of creative stuff, some stuff very early on, right after the election, even before the inauguration. Tell us about a little, there were a couple of actions both before and right following the inauguration. Tell us about what the group did.
Yeah, we began meeting shortly after the election, and the healthcare group tried to figure out, you know, where here in New York we could find a good symbolic target. And somebody mentioned that there is a fancy restaurant in the Trump Hotel at Columbus Circle. So 15 of us made reservations there for lunch, for brunch on Sunday, and held a cough-in. So we've done, you know, die-ins and sit-ins. We did a cough-in where I began coughing, and then someone else began coughing, and then someone else, and soon all 15 of us were coughing, and the entire restaurant looked up, and then we had all hidden posters saying Trump Care makes us sick. Even though Trump Care hadn't been revealed yet, we knew it was going to be horrible. There was no question. And it got amazing coverage, the idea of disrupting. And it's interesting that a lot of the diners there were pretty upset, but the staff was totally supportive. They were smiling during the whole thing. And then we went outside, and there were like 500 people waiting outside for us. So that got some great press. And we've been, you know, continually trying to keep the pressure up. And it's very clear that among all these senators' constituents, the health care proposals are incredibly unpopular. USA Today recently released a poll saying only 12% of Americans support the Republican health care bill. So that's really strong. And we're, in what Jen said and what Rise and Resist is doing, we're expressing that. We did an action against the Medicaid block grants, which have now, I think, been turned into Medicaid caps instead. Right, Mark?
Well, I think the bills let states take either approach. It's up to them. They can either do a straight-up block grant or they can do a per capita cap block grant. But they're all variations on the same theme.
Yeah, so we did an action where people who rely on Medicaid, older people, disabled people, and just ordinary people, held blocks that stated why they need Medicaid. And then we had the trillionaires for Trump come and take those block grants away and say, I need this for my tax cut. And we've realized that while the health care bill is incredibly unpopular with virtually the entire voting public, it's incredibly popular with one very important constituency, and that is the incredibly wealthy Republican donors who have recently said, we are cutting off all campaign contributions until you repeal Obamacare. And that's a voice that I think you agree, Jen, really speaks every bit as loudly as our voice. We could have hundreds, thousands of people out there, and yet those few hundred donors, with the incredible amount of money they give, are just as powerful as we are. So we need an incredibly strong force of ordinary people out there to counteract the powerful voice of the Koch brothers, Adelson, Mercer, all these donors who control the purse strings.
Jennifer, you talked about trying to break into the media and how that actually finally began to happen. I know the media oftentimes operate in silos. Local reporters cover things from a local angle, national reporters from national, and they weren't kind of working together. So what have been the narratives that have been there in the media on this?
The most amazing thing, I think, is that, you know, it's so easy. Every single person that you talk to, everybody has a story about their health care and
yes.
How they, you know, everybody. I mean, people walk around thinking that they're healthy, and then I think I'm perfectly healthy, but then I realize I've had two C-sections, so that's a pre-existing condition. I actually had a Graves' disease, which is a thyroid disorder, so I have another pre-existing condition.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I had never really thought about it. I run every day, you know, in pretty good shape, but actually I would be someone who would be too sick to be able to qualify for the healthcare plans that would be offered under the House or the Senate plan. And so just having people tell those stories has been, I think, enormously powerful. And I do think that it's the counter narrative that Mark was alluding to the enormous greed. I mean, there's 22 million people who are going to lose healthcare. I think that we should just put that out there again under mm-hmm. under the Senate plan. 23 million under the House plan.
And 32 million if Obamacare is just repealed, as they're now saying.
Right.
Right.
And in New York, under the Senate plan alone, and with the caveat that this would be an unimaginable number if Obamacare is just repealed. 1 million, over 1,139,000 people would lose health coverage in New York State alone. 1 million people, over 1 million people would lose Medicaid. And yet it's only 43,590 millionaires in New York would get a tax break. Now, actually, that number is very large. It's unbelievable that there's that many millionaires.
Well, we do have
in
a lot really
of
in New York, yeah. Right.
But you know, they're doing this for basically an average of $53,000 less that they would have to pay taxes. And they're millionaires, so let's you know, not feel bad for them. I mean, that would be a huge number if they weren't millionaires. So, you know, I think just having the stories of how many of us, you know, I've had actually close, I've had about $30,000 in health debt before, so... and, you know, my story is not unique. I've always actually had health coverage, and yet I still had that health debt. So, you mm-hmm. know, when you put that into context, we really, you know, the thing that seems to, that we need to get out there is to have the counter narrative to the enormous greed.
It was interesting. Last week, there was a hands around the Capitol action in D.C., and there were solidarity actions at federal buildings all around the country. The organization you mentioned, Healthcare for America Now, and SEIU, the Service Employees International Union, sort of coordinated it. And the one here in New York City was organized in less than 48 hours. About 200 people showed up. And toward the end of it, we offered them the opportunity to just tell their stories to see who would step forward and tell them. And people really did, and they had the most moving, compelling stories to share, and they really wanted to share it. That's what was really kind of most interesting about it, and how those stories can have power, you know, to sort of say this is what it's really all about. So, Mark, the Rise and Resist is up to an action this week. Can you tell us what's in the works?
Yeah, the narrative we're trying to focus on, that I find when I ask my liberal friends, you know, what's behind the Republican health care plan, why are they pushing this, a lot of them don't get that this is a complete transfer of wealth. That's all it is. It's not a health care bill, it's a tax cut bill, and I would say it's even a transfer of health. So, you know, 22 million people will lose their health care, and the richest millionaires in the United States will get an enormous amount of money. So you're literally taking the money that keeps people healthy, and you're giving it to millionaires. And so we want to make that very clear. So tomorrow night, July 6th, we are meeting at 72nd and 5th Avenue right inside Central Park there. And we're going to march to David Koch's apartment building. He lives here in Manhattan. And we're going to accuse him and all the other rich Republican donors of literally conspiring to take health care away from millions so that they can make more money. Because the fact that David Koch has, I don't know, you know, $10 billion isn't enough. He needs $10.5 billion. And in order to get that, he needs to make sure that poor people in West Virginia, where in some areas 60% of people rely on Medicaid, he needs to make sure that they don't get access to doctors. And it's just, so we're going to be dumping body bags and coffins and money bags on their doorsteps. And the theme of the action is that Republicans are addicted to Coke, K-O-C-H. Because they're addicted to this money that comes from these rich donors and will do pretty much whatever they say, even when 88% of the country is opposed to it. So I hope people can join us. 5:30 p.m. Tomorrow night, July 6th, 72nd and 5th Avenue in the park. And by the way, dress in black because we're doing a death march.
Jennifer, sort of looking forward, what do you think is it may take to sort of get the political powers that be in Washington to really understand, as Mark said, that this is not supported by the American people?
Fortunately or unfortunately, it's actually very simple. It just is going to take a tremendous amount of action on our part. We can't let go. We can't let up. I mean, I remember in the, you know, in January and February, we were all looking forward to the summer because we knew back then that every single weekend would have to be filled with marches, that, you know, our weekends were going to change from brunch with friends to, you know, donuts and coffee at a march with friends. And so we're going to have to actually, you know, that's what we're going to have to do. We're going to have to continue this unimaginable amount of action. So starting with when they get back, you know, and we're winning. Every day we delay, yes, we're winning. It's just that we can't let up because it's easy for them to whip themselves together and to get a vote. It's easy for them to give each other money and swap power and give each other new seats on committees. That's very easy for them to do. They can do it in a couple hours. So we need to continue this level of action. So when they get back into office on Monday, July 10th, from their July 4th recess, we're going to throw them an unwelcome party in Washington, D.C. And if anyone would like to get involved, they can contact me at jflynn, F-L-Y-N-N, at populardemocracy.org. And I can help you get to Washington, D.C. and talk to you more about what we've got in the works. And then after that, if we can actually make it to the August recess, we need every single day when they're home, every clam bake they go to, every vacation town they visit, every press conference they hold, every fundraiser they attend, for people to be out there talking about healthcare. And we can't let up on the phone calls. So we've got the month of July, you know, from July 10th until they go out for August recess. The first day of August recess is Saturday, July 29th. So for those
weeks, about 3 weeks.
Yeah, then. 3 weeks, a little bit less than a month. So for that, those 3 weeks, you need to be constantly calling into their office, set an alarm on your phone with the phone number that's just, you know, call Senator so-and-so right now. Don't limit it to your own senator. Call the senators that actually are on the fence that can make the decision. They're deciding your health care fate, whether or not you live or die. You have every right in the world to call them. So those are Senator Portman, Senator Collins, Senator Capito, to some extent, you know, Senator Cruz, Senator Lee, Senator Rubio.
Murkowski
from Alaska, yes.
Right. Heller in Nevada.
Heller, definitely
one.
Very important.
He came out against the Senate bill, and he's getting a lot of flack from his party.
Yes, so call him and congratulate him on his bravery. And then on July 29th, there's a big call for having those marches, having marches in every single district, targeting your key elected. So this doesn't just have to be your senator. This could be your member of Congress. If they voted for the bad bill, then, you know, yell at them. And if they voted against it, then congratulate them. And if they're senators and they've yet to vote, then let them know that you do not want them to support any bill that repeals Obamacare. And so that's Saturday, July 29th, and there's a number of national organizations. This was initiated by the Hub Project, but it's, you know, Center for Popular Democracy. It's Our Future. That's the name. Yeah, Our Future. It's lots and lots and lots of
right.
other national organizations
right.
that are calling for it.
Yeah, and I guess the good news for us. Go ahead, Mark.
And people need to know. We want to emphasize that liking things on Facebook and signing online petitions may feel good, but it does nothing. You have to make those phone calls. You have to show up at the actions. You have to get involved with the groups that are organizing the actions. We have to actually put our bodies on the line. And Jen is right. They're waiting for us to lose steam, for us to just throw our hands up and get exhausted, and we can't. We have to be out there every single week, pushing over and over and keeping the pressure on them, and that's the only way we can win this.
And I have one more thing to say about that, which is that, you know, the cliche, we are the ones we're waiting for, it's really so true. Don't wait for me and Mark to tell you what action to take. You know, go forth, organize a kids' march, or get together your group of veterans, have them set up a meeting with your local elected official. Jump in the car. Take all of these ideas, you know, the coffin that Mark described. There are a lot of restaurants around, you know, Senator Heller's office. If you're nearby, go do a coffin, start at a restaurant, march over, send out a press release. definitely you can contact us for help, you know, press list, whatever, but don't wait for someone else to organize it. This is the time for everybody to take action. Whatever you think is a good idea, I think it's a good idea too. So go do it.
And I dare say you can just sort of put some keywords into a search engine online and you'll find lots of groups that are doing stuff. Mark, maybe just quickly, since Rise and Resist is a local group here in New York, maybe tell people when and where they meet and how they could get involved with them.
Yeah, Rise and Resist is a group formed in the model of ACT UP. It's a complete town hall democracy. There's no hierarchy. Anybody has as strong a voice as anybody else. We meet every Tuesday evening from 7 to 9 p.m. at a church at 13th Street and 7th Avenue.
It's
Church
on,
of the Village,
the
13th Street and 7th Avenue. And it's a great, it's great to be in a room with hundreds of other people who are as committed as you are. And we're all working together, and then we break off into other groups to plan actions. And, you know, with the Trump administration, there are literally dozens of different issues that you need to focus on. You pick the one that's the most important to you. If you want to work on healthcare, the healthcare group generally meets a half an hour before the meeting at 6:30 to plan our next action. So, yeah, join us. Go on Facebook, Rise and Resist NYC. All our information is posted there. Join the Facebook group and come to a meeting. But, you know, put your body and your voice out there, not just your mouse and your keyboard.
Great. Well, thank you very much. We've been talking about all the current activism that's happening locally and nationally around the congressional health care bills. Our guests have been Mark Milano, who's a member of Rise and Resist and a leader of their healthcare action group, and Jennifer Flynn, who's a consultant and healthcare action coordinator with the Center for Popular Democracy. Thanks for joining us, Mark and Jennifer, on Health Action.
Thank you so much.
And thanks for Reggie Johnson for engineering this segment. Catherine Davis will be with you in the next half of the program talking about the whole holistic eye care. Stay tuned. I'm Mark Hannay.
And I am here. This is Catherine Davis, co-host to Health Action, also host of Heart of Mind, which now is heard on Mondays at 1 p.m. in the afternoon. But I had an opportunity to be here live with you this morning for Health Action because I wanted to have a conversation with John Monroe. And he is a holistic eye care educator. And many of you know him because he has been assisting WBAI during our fund drives and making some of his material available. And it's been quite popular with all of you who listen into this radio station. So I wanted to welcome John Monroe back so that he can remind you of the work that he does and can talk to you about his upcoming live event here in New York City. So I want to say hello and welcome back, John Monroe.
Yeah, hi, Kathy. How's it going tonight?
It's going well, thank you. And this is going to be an interesting event, I believe, and hopefully people will turn out to support you. I think that you have done a lot to support WBAI for sure. So let me remind people that you are an educator and you have been working, continuing the work of Dr. Banker, who had a beautiful career in helping people with holistic information. So just very, very briefly, you know, for anyone who might not be familiar with Dr. Banker and your work, can you remind us of what her legacy was and how you're continuing that work?
Well, Dr. Deborah Banker was an MD ophthalmologist. You know, she was a cataract surgeon, and she went to universities for 14 years in different states and other countries. And after a while, she started doing more holistic alternative approaches to eye diseases and improving nearsightedness and farsightedness, you know, presbyopia, trouble reading small print, and pretty much all the different eye diseases and eye disorders that you can think of. And basically, she just wanted to help people see better and, you know, kind of saw how the bureaucracy and the government and people that get involved in health care, you know, the things they're doing, and how expensive it was getting. So she tried to find a more simple approach to these problems and the causes and symptoms and how to reverse them without drugs and surgery. And she always just thought she was fighting blindness. She always felt like she was the only person doing it, but, you know, there's a lot of people out there doing it, but a lot of people, she said, are just trying to make a lot of money off people's blindness and not really doing much for them. You know, their problems are getting worse. Their eyesight's getting worse. They're having bad side effects to eye surgeries and pharmaceutical drugs. And, you know, when I met her, she was way into this stuff. And I'd met her in 1991 out in Los Angeles. And in 1993, August, I actually started working full-time with her. And it was just amazing to see how her equipment and her approach to these problems would work and actually help people. And it was kind of amazing how simple it was. You know, if you can get the person to get involved in it and help themselves, you know, and empower themselves, there's a lot people can do to prevent getting diseases and problems and how to prevent them and how to improve them.
Very well. And so let's cover a little. Well, first, let's just let people know when the event is happening. It's on August 9th. What are you calling it?
It's basically, I'm going to be speaking on behalf of Dr. Banker. You know, I was trained by her. I worked with her for 15 years every day in her clinic and pretty much learned her whole approach and programs and things for improving eyesight, and we also work on other things, you know. High blood pressure is a big problem, diabetes, you know, weight loss, arthritis and gout, beauty and rejuvenation, you know, the better someone looks, the less stressed out they are. There's a lot of things that affect the eyesight, stress, anger, being emotionally upset. There's just a lot of things that can affect the eyes, the diet, the lifestyle people are living, you know, their environment. And the lecture is basically the Dr. Banker Natural Vision Improvement Lecture. And we're going to do this at the New York Society for Ethical Culture building. That's where we're trying to, you know, that's where it's set up for. And they have a big lecture room there called Social Hall. And we're going to be using that room. It's downstairs. And it's on Wednesday night. And it's from 7 p.m. to 8:30 p.m. And it's on August 9th is what I was trying to say. And I'm trying not to make it too long. You know, I don't want people getting tired and sitting there for 2-3 hours. But I think in an hour and a half we can cover a lot of different problems. And I'll be giving out information and things people can do to improve their different eye problems. You know, I'll be speaking about cataracts and what's causing them and the symptoms and what you can do to reverse them. I'll be talking about macular degeneration, diabetic retinopathy, just a whole gamut of eye problems, diabetic retinopathy, retinitis pigmentosa. There's just so many problems, the nearsightedness, the farsightedness, the presbyopia, the trouble reading small print. We'll also have some of our products there that people can look at. And actually see what this is. You know, they can look at it and see it and meet us. And after the lecture, we're going to be out in the lobby for like an hour and a half or an hour, and people can actually order products, and we'll mail them to them when we get back. We don't want to bring a lot of stuff with us because it's, you know, just way more expense and time to take care of all that. So we're trying this out to see how it'll go, this lecture. And it's, you know, the work we do is for all ages. I mean, parents learn about this and teach their children. You know, we've worked with people in their 80s and 90s. It doesn't matter. You know, if someone wants to try this, we're willing to work with them. Mm-hmm. And also I have a few people that have worked with us that are going to come to the lecture, and they're going to talk a little bit about their experience working with us. One guy, George, he lives in New Jersey, and he had cataracts in each eye, and he got some of the stuff we work with, some of our Chinese herbal medicines and started doing some of the stuff he could get at the health food store. And in 2 months, his cataracts were gone. And he couldn't believe it. I mean, he's just amazed that not everybody's lined up out the door calling us nonstop about this. And he might bring a friend with him mm-hmm. who had cataract surgery in each eye. And when they did it, they did both eyes at the same time, which is kind of strange. But the surgery seemed to go okay, seemed all right, but 5 months later, he went blind in each eye from the cataract surgery. So I'm trying to get George to bring him with him so he can explain what happened. And, you know, it's just so different to see George having such improvement in such a short time for just a few $100s, where this other guy went and had all this major surgery, which cost thousands of dollars, and 5 months later, he lost his sight.
Well, that's an interesting dilemma. My understanding with cataracts is that you do reach a point where it becomes much more difficult to reverse
right.
it. So what is the dynamic in terms of this particular issue that people can reverse it, and at what point that it does it become more difficult through these holistic means?
There's a lot of different types of cataracts. But most people get a senile cataract or a nuclear cataract. The nuclear cataract's the easiest one to reverse. The senile's the second. A post-subcapsular cataract, there's not much you can do for that one. That's
can
if
you,
someone gets
can you,
hit in the eye.
Can you explain what the three of them are?
Well, they're basically a cataract is oxidized cells in the lens. It's kind of like rust on metal, and you know how the rust, if you don't mm-hmm. do anything, it just keeps growing and more rust spreads. And just depending on what what area of the lens it starts in and the progression of it, you know, how fast they're growing, that's how they categorize different ones. There's Christmas tree cataracts where you see little green and red spots and things in your eyesight, so they call it a Christmas tree cataract. The post-subcapsular cataract, if you have one of those, that's usually caused by something bumping the lens in the eye. A lot of times when they do retinal surgery, they can bump the lens with the equipment, and it can start a post-subcapsular cataract. Or people can get punched in the eye or get hit in the eye by something, and it bumps the lens, and it causes the post-subcapsular cataract. And cataracts go by stages. So a stage one cataract is very small. It can even, sometimes they'll say you have a very tiny beginning cataract, or they'll say you have a stage one, or your cataract's a stage two cataract. So we can work with beginning cataracts that are just beginning all the way up to stage two. Stage three and four, the cataract has just spread too much. You know, it's gotten too big, and it's hard to reverse it. We've even helped people with like a 2.5 cataract. But, you know, the people have to work at it. There's medicine you take. There's eye drops you use. There's supplements, herbs, vitamins, some things you can get at the health food store. You know, and we'll be explaining all this at the lecture. And that's just dealing with cataracts.
Wow. So yeah, so a lot of it has to do with how you stand, what state your eyes are actually in.
Yeah, how big the cataract is, you know, what stage it is and what type it is.
Okay, but it's good to know that there is something that people can do.
Oh yeah,
I've
been doing
this
since 1993, and we've helped thousands and thousands of people get rid of their cataracts.
Can you give us a little bit of a taste of the lecture, like maybe something on nutrition and how that impacts, or is it massage? Is it, you know, what are the different things that people can explore to improve their eyesight?
Well, we will have some of our vision improvement kits there, the self-help vision care kit that Dr. Banker developed. You can see it on our website at drbanker.com. You just click on the products link on the homepage, and it says right there, you know, a little menu comes down. It says Vision Improvement Kit. You click on that. You can see the kit, what's in it, read about it. it also has a thing there under that. It says medicinal herbs. You can click on that and see the different Chinese herbs that we use for different eye problems. And I'll be explaining a lot about the kit and how it works and things that people have done with it. And it goes through a series of different exercises, and they're from different countries. They're from China. They're from Tibet. They're from India. They're exercises, excuse me, they're exercises that Dr. Banker developed. And there's a whole chapter in the book on nutrition, diet, supplements, herbs, vitamins. There's eye charts to check your distance vision. There's an eye chart to check your reading vision, so you can check your own eyesight at home. And the whole kit's designed so you work with it at home. You don't have to go somewhere. You know, a lot of vision therapists, you have to go see them once a week for an hour, and they want you to do 15 weeks, and they charge you like $100 an hour. And you have to go down there and back home. And so she designed it so you could just work at home. And like I said, little children work with this to people in their 90s.
Right. And what I'd like for you to do, if you could, is share some information with people who are listening about some aspect of what your lecture is going to be. Give them a taste of concrete information.
Well, the things I'm going to be covering are all these different eye problems. And, you know, I'll be talking to people about macular degeneration, what's causing that. A lot of things cause the macular degeneration: cigarettes, alcohol, sugar, tannic acid that's in coffee and chocolates and different things. There's a lot of things people just don't realize what they're eating and what it's doing to their eyes. You know, exposure to sunlight. I'll be talking about a lot of different things. And, you know, I'll go through cataracts, and I'm going to go through macular degeneration. I'll go through nearsightedness and farsightedness. So it's not just a lecture. It's kind of like an office visit with us for an hour and a half, covering all these problems and the solutions for it. And that's basically what it's about. It's kind of like our workshop, too. You know, it's a combination of things for everybody. And a lot of people that I talk to, they're always asking, well, when are you coming to New York? You know, and I said, well, we do workshops. And, you know, we do those on Saturday from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m., and we go through the whole program, and we're right there with everybody. I've had people leave our workshops without their reading glasses, and their you know, their nearsightedness is improving because they have very weak prescriptions. You know, the stronger your prescription is in your glasses or contacts or readers, the more time it's going to take to reverse it. But people that are 1.50, a 2.0, we've had them improve their eyesight for reading in like a week, you know, 2 weeks. They don't need the glasses anymore. And it'll be a great lecture. And the thing about it is, when everybody's there and you see everybody there, you're going to see all these people and all the different problems they have. And it's really an epidemic in the whole world, eye problems and eye diseases, things that are going on. And a lot of it's caused by using glasses and contacts and readers and bifocals. Because when you wear glasses, they help the symptom. They help you see better. But they don't help the cause of the problem. So that's why when you're nearsighted and your prescription is getting stronger and stronger and you keep getting stronger glasses, you're becoming more blind. Your nearsightedness is getting worse. And if you get too nearsighted, you're prone to have a retinal tear, a retinal detachment, floaters develop. So, these are a lot of things we'll be talking about: reading glasses and bifocals, trifocals, progressive lenses. They after using those for 10 years, they can cause cataracts and glaucoma to develop.
Okay, well, that's good information. If people
it's the things people don't know. The other eye doctors, they don't tell them this.
Right, because there's no economy in people recovering their health. I mean, I think that's a problem
overall.
Oh,
it's all about money.
It's a problem overall in health care.
Right.
And from my perspective, one of the best insurance policies is to take some responsibility for those things that we can change.
Right.
And if there's a possibility of improving one's eyesight, then I think that's one of the greatest gifts, and it would be worthwhile to make that effort at the least. But I do think that and I would include myself in this number, that it's easy to become lazy about these things when the situation does not seem so serious to you. Wearing glasses, if you have a low prescription or a moderate prescription, it doesn't seem all that serious, but as an individual. But at what point should people really be concerned that things are really taking a downturn for themselves?
Well, if you're wearing glasses, you're having a problem already. And, you know, if you go to, it's good to go to an ophthalmologist and have your eye examined at least once a year or maybe every 2 years. Because if they can go in and detect that you have a cataract starting, you know, it's good to know. Then you can call us and we can help you with it. Or, you know, they can detect glaucoma, or they can notice, hey, you have some macular degeneration starting. Or, you know, diabetics, they get a lot of diabetic retinopathy. That's a problem with the retina. And we also have things can do. We help people all the time get rid of diabetes. And, you know, this is what I've been doing for the past over 20 years.
Yeah, so it seems to me that in many ways the eyes are almost like the canary they take down into the caves to give you an early warning of toxic air, because the eyes themselves are very sensitive and are going to be impacted perhaps before other parts of your body may be impacted. Not necessarily, but it's possible, I would think.
Well, out of all the eye diseases that we work with, retinitis pigmentosa and glaucoma. Glaucoma is the worst. I mean, that can damage your optic nerve, and that's neurological tissue. And we have found things now that are helping the optic nerve to rejuvenate. And there's a lot of studies now being done on stem cells, and I'll be talking about that, and people that are doing studies on it that people can contact. And I think in the next few years, we're going to see a lot of improvements in stem cells for some of these problems. But glaucoma's got to be the worst that I've seen to work with. The other ones, cataracts and macular degeneration and, you know, retinal problems of all different types, uveitis, iritis, blepharitis. I mean, there's Stargardt's. We work with that. There's just a lot of different problems people have. Retinal sheaths is a big problem.
What's that?
Retinal sheaths is the retina is the inner lining of the eye. It's like a tube in a tire. So the lining of the eye is called the retina. And it's only the thickness of tissue paper. But the retina is made up of all these different layers, kind of like an onion. And in those layers, they can start separating. And where they separate, it can start causing a vision problem. And that's called retinal sheaths. And we've healed that up in a lot of people, you know, with treatments that we do out at the clinic we've done in the past. There's even a person that worked with us on that on our website, if you click the testimonials. And just after the first day of treatment, she started seeing better. Mm. But retinal sheaths is another problem, and that's just the retina layers start separating.
And what does that appear like to the person who has that condition?
When a doctor looks in your eye, now they can take pictures of the retina and the inner eye. They're really getting good with that. And you just see like a spot or a line, a white line or spot on the retina. Because the retina is clear, you can see right through it. You know, you see the blood vessels in it, which mm-hmm. are about the size of a human hair. They're mm-hmm. very small. But you'll see, like with macular degeneration, when you look at the photo of the inner eye, you'll see white spots on the retina. And that's how you can detect where it is and what it is. So Dr. Banker could actually look in somebody's eye and see these white spots or the retinal sheaths area. And as you work with the treatments and program and, you know, your diet and herbs and everything, she could look in the eye again and see these things, that they'll be gone or they're getting smaller. That's how you can kind of track them. And now they have cameras that take pictures of the inside of the eye, and they do really, really amazing
Are there
photos.
Symptoms necessary? You know, because you were advising that people do go to an ophthalmologist to make sure can catch these things in early stages.
Well, if you're sitting around and you have your eyes closed and you move your eyes left or right. I mean, it's a little test you can do. Just close your eyes, move them left and right, up and down in the dark, and see if you see any white flashes. Or if you're just sitting there and you notice flashes in your eye, a lot of times that's from the retina. Or in our kit, the vision improvement kit, we have a thing called the Amsler's grid, and it's a square, and it has a bunch of lines going up and down, left and right. And you hold that up in front of your face and look at it, and if some of those lines look wavy or broken or you can't see them, then there's something going on with the retina. It's called the Amsler's grid. And a lot of doctors, when you go have your eye examined, they do visual field tests. And, you know, a visual field test is good. The Amsler's grid works good. Just if you notice any change in your vision, say if you wake up one morning and your visual field is like black or half of it's black, you have a severe problem going on.
Okay.
So any change in your normal vision, you should definitely call an ophthalmologist and have them examine your eyes. They're real good at diagnosing problems, but it's the way they go about working with them is where we come in. And Dr. Banker did 20 years of research and study on eye diseases and eye problems and what's causing them and what to do about them. I mean, she was an eye specialist, and she did research on this.
And you've been working with her for many years. Now, Dr. Banker has passed away, and you're continuing
the
legacy.
Yeah, she died in May 2007, and before she did, she told me that if I wanted to continue the work and the practice, since I knew how to do it, Jeannie Mainzer works with me. And she's a certified kinesiologist.
And we're actually out of time, unfortunately, right. John. I wasn't watching the clock. And,
all right.
But no, I want to give your phone number that you want people to contact you.
Yeah, we're selling tickets at Eventbrite. There's a link on our homepage for the lecture, drbanker.com. And if anybody wants to call me, the office number in Boulder is 303-494-4532.
Say that again.
303-494-4532, drbanker.com. The number's on the website. And I'm here Monday through Saturday, 10 a.m. to 7 p.m. Mountain Time.
Okay, got to run, John. Thank you.
All right, thank you, Kathy.
All right, bye-bye now.
Bye.
And that's for August 9th lecture at the New York Society for Ethical Culture. You've been listening to Health Action. Stay tuned for Jim Freund and Hour of the Wolf. This is Nawang Ketchog, Music is Medicine.
Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. Our guest this morning, via recorded interview from about 2 years ago, a rebroadcast actually, Linda Nagata, one of the greats. Stay tuned. Thank you.
I'm Dan Persons, movie reviewer for Hour of the Wolf. It's a question of tone for me. I don't think it's particularly hard to mistake Bong Joon-ho's newest film, Okja, now running on Netflix, for a Spielbergian child's adventure fantasy, with a young Korean girl, Mija, played by An Jo-hyun, having her immense roly-poly, quasi-hippopotamus-like, and surprisingly adorable, quote-unquote, super pig, the titular Okja, stolen away from her by an evil, multinational agri-corporation with the intent of introducing the world to the wonders of Okja sausage, among other foodstuffs. There are beautiful and amusing forest-bound pastoral sequences. Can you use pastoral for a forest setting? At the beginning of the film, with a truly gripping moment of peril that demonstrates both the bond between girl and super pig and the inherent intelligence of the lumbering beast. There's a fantastically mounted chase scene through the city of Seoul between a tractor-trailer truck loaded with Okja and another piloted by PETA-like activists led by Paul Dano, intent on rescuing the creature. And not to be too spoilery about it, but there is a happy ending that reunites Mija and Okja and delivers the message that families come in many unconventional forms. But the liberal invocation of the F word throughout the film is one indication that this isn't really meant for kids. Another is when Dano brutally beats a member of his organization for having lied to him. And while it's no surprise that the final act features Mija's horrific visit to a super pig processing plant, the intensity of the sequence edges closer to the showers sequence from Schindler's List than the government incursion from E.T. We're out of the realm of wonder here and into some truly dark stuff. And this has been a problem with me, with director Bong Joon-ho, particularly in his previous film, Snowpiercer. An uneasy fit between a fanciful mise-en-scene and an unsparing attitude towards a story's darker aspects. It's especially notable in the sculpting of his villains. Here, a pair of twin industrialists, played by Tilda Swinton, and an idiosyncratic and self-absorbed zoologist, played by Jake Gyllenhaal. Both actors manage to push boundaries in terms of scenery chewing, but Gyllenhaal takes the prize in a truly unpleasant sequence in which he unleashes a variety of tortures upon the helpless Okja. I don't particularly blame the actors. From my experience with Snowpiercer, this is clearly what Joon-ho wants. But in such company, I was grateful for Giancarlo Esposito's relatively restrained presence as a Machiavellian second-in-command. I am willing to admit personal weakness here. Tons of praise was heaped upon Snowpiercer, and likely Okja is in store for the same. Whatever people are sinking into in Joon-ho's storytelling style, that stuff, the operatic performances, the dance between whimsy and cynicism, there's a massive public event, or it's suggested it's massive, to greet Okja's arrival in New York that looks nothing like a thing that would be staged in America. That stuff just naturally grates on me. And it's not like I don't appreciate black humor or introducing real-world consequences into otherwise light fantasy. But it isn't working for me here. I can't say that Bong Joon-ho doesn't know what he's doing, and certainly the quality of the film, his commitment to the world he's building, and the story he's telling cannot be denied. I'm left wanting to praise Okja, and stymied by a style that keeps me from doing so wholeheartedly. For Hour of the Wolf, I'm Dan Persons, hashtag ITMFA.
And thank you, Dan. Yeah, I watched the trailer for Okja earlier tonight, as a matter of fact, and I have to say, you know, it really does sound interesting, and when you realize that this is, well, it looks offhand like a family-friendly kind of movie, and then you realize that this comes from the same person who made Snowpiercer. Now, I've got to tell you, Snowpiercer sounds like a fascinating film. I might well enjoy it if it wasn't for the extreme gore, and I am not a fan of extreme gore at all. It keeps me, it stops me from wanting to see certain films, because if the image, pardon me while I'm trying to plug a flash drive in, I was using one computer and that wasn't working, so now I'm going for another, and I can never find where the flash drive insert is on computer one, assuming it's computer one that I want, which I think it is. There we are. Alrighty. So, now see if I can... So I am switched over there. So I'm probably... This is Win 10. I have to tell you, I'm not a Win 10 person. I am a Win 7 type.